Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
It's the history of the Tottenham. It's the history of the Tottenham. It's the history of the Tottenham. They miss always something. They concede many chances every game. Many chances every game. It's the history of the Tottenham. Tottenham. It's the history of the Tottenham.
Hello and welcome to another Arsecast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, good evening to you.
Good evening to you too.
Good
How
evening.
You doing, Andrew?
I'm okay. I turned on the last couple of minutes of the Carabao Cup final. I've got much better things to do with my time and my life than watch Tottenham in any way, shape or form, right?
Of course.
But I just finished a game of Rocket League, and I said, I'll just turn on the end of the game and see what's happening, because I was checking Twitter to see what was happening, and there hadn't been a goal. And I just as I turned the TV on to the football, they were celebrating. I could see Man City fans actually celebrating in the stands at Wembley, and they just scored. So I watched the last few minutes, and you take your laughs where you can get them these days if you're an Arsenal fan, right?
Yeah, you saw the satisfying sight of Heung-min Son weeping at the final whistle.
Yes. I mean,
I enjoyed your tweet,
like,
by the way. Oh, cheers, Son's crying.
Yeah.
Very funny.
I, the minute I saw him, I was like, oh, fuck, I got to get this out, because like 4,000 million people will be doing the exact same tweet if they get it out before me. So I hope I was first. I don't know. But look, you know, it was an obvious one. What do you call that? Tap-in. You know, couldn't miss.
Yeah.
I
enjoyed Tom Rosenthal, who is a big Arsenal fan, the actor. He tweeted saying, Spurs, people aren't talking enough about the fact that Spurs hired a cup specialist trophy winning manager and then sacked him a week before a final. That is quite an extraordinary mess, isn't it, to have got into that position?
I know. I mean, look, it's every time you think they can't be more Spursy than they already are, they find a way. They find a way.
It's restored a little of my faith in football, I'll be honest, you know. My opinion on the sport, it's been a tough week for all of us.
It has.
I think football needed that, really did.
Yeah, it has been a crazy week. I mean, I was saying to someone the other day that, you know, it felt like about 7 months long last week, because so much happened and so much was going on and so much was changing, you know, not even day to day, but hour to hour, you know, all through the week. And then, of course, you know, we had that game of football that we're going to discuss now in a minute. And, you know, just what were your broad thoughts on the week that was? I know it's very difficult probably to do that without going into specifics, like what do you think of this, what do you think of that, but were you left exhausted at the end of the week?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. And kind of, I mean that on every count. I mean, emotionally, there was a lot of it was a big roller coaster. Professionally, it was quite a draining period, constantly trying to find out what was going on. And yeah, I felt completely exhausted by it. And then, of course, it all culminated in Friday evening, the protest that happened outside the ground. By the time I actually got into the stadium and the game kicked off, I was pretty much spent. It was one of those where I almost feel bad saying this because I know there are people who would kill to be in a stadium at the moment, but it was difficult. It was quite difficult to focus, actually, on the match, given the wider context and everything we have experienced this week. It's been crazy, and I actually feel setting the Everton match aside, pretty good about the outcome in terms of, I think that, you know, Arsenal aren't in the Super League, the Super League's not happening. There seems to have been a real kind of rallying round of the Arsenal fans and a greater sense of unity and purpose and unity of purpose than there has been maybe for some time. So overall, I feel positive, I think. But the football and the match in particular was a significant dent in that feeling.
Right. Okay. So I suppose we should, given that we are nominally a football podcast, talk about the football first. And the Super League thing, you know, it's been done to death and it is a dead thing. But obviously the repercussions of what happened rumble on. And we saw that on Friday with the protests. And that's something that we're going to have to talk about. So we'll do that. But, you know, this team's ability, James, to lose games that it should not lose is a problem, big problem now, right? Because I don't think we were particularly good against Everton. I know we were missing some key players and everything else, but we weren't under any real threat in the game. I thought the only danger to ourselves was ourselves, and so it proved, not quite in the way that I thought or envisaged. I was on the live blog, I was going, Everton have been so bad in this, I was typing this out, Everton have been so bad in this half, their goal is really going to... And then they scored. I didn't even get the chance to finish the thought. So, you know, in terms of the performance, look, we could go over the nuts and bolts of it, I guess, but it's just this self-destruct button went off again.
Yeah, and I was actually thinking after the game, I mean, Arsenal do keep finding ways to not win matches, and an interesting thing has kind of happened, hasn't it, in football analysis, particularly among, you know, your own team, where I think we're inclined to look at process, we're inclined to look at performances. You know, I think we're not necessarily as geared around analysing the results as perhaps we once were. But I think a consequence of that is that maybe sometimes we don't look enough at the results. And sometimes when you lose a match like this and you step back and you think, how many Premier League games have we lost this season? 13 from 33. It really is troubling. And I think even Mikel Arteta's staunchest supporters would have to say he doesn't win enough games currently in the Premier League. He just doesn't. And I don't think it's that Arsenal are awful in these matches. You know, they say the mark of a good team is that they win when they're not playing well. Well, what does it say about our team that we often don't win and when we're sort of... Well, yeah, we don't play well either, but even when it's sort of not necessarily a bad day by our own standards, we can lose without playing badly. Let's put it like that.
Yeah, that's it. Our ability to lose a game or drop points when, you know, we really shouldn't be. And there are many games this season that you could talk about, and certainly the one against Everton was one of them. Like, it's not as if we had Jordan Pickford diving from pillar to post and making all kinds of saves and playing attacking, threatening football. But I thought we were on top in the second half.
In the first half, they had chances. You know, they hit the bar for the free kick, and Leno made a decent save at one point.
Oh, that was the shot that deflected off Holding.
Yes, exactly. But in the second half, you're right, it was kind of one-way traffic. And we do keep finding ways to lose. And it's difficult, this, because if it was happening every so often, you'd go, oh, well, that, you know, that happens. Arsenal are doing everything right. Every so often, you don't get the luck, you don't get the breaks. But it's a real pattern, I think, at this point.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's all, I think it's not unreasonable to say that we are a team that don't get any breaks at the moment. If there's any luck going, it's bad luck. And I think that's true. But it's also combined with, the inability to create enough chances to offset, as we said before, like when mistakes happen, when you do the shooting yourself in the foot thing, you have some wiggle room if you can score goals. And we're a team that doesn't score anywhere near enough goals. I was listening to the Arsenal Vision Instant Reaction podcast yesterday, and Tim was saying that it's, 17 goals in 18 home games, or 18 goals in 17 home games, whatever it is.
And I think we've conceded one more than we've scored.
You know?
So we've got a negative goal difference.
Yeah, and there's a tweet here from the purveyor of doom stats, you know, which are also just facts. Orbino, Arsenal have failed to score in 12 Premier League games this season, the most ever in a 38-game season for the Gunners in the competition. And, you know, there's still some games to go in which we may not score as well. So,
yeah.
You know,
I mean, listen, we, in this game, as I say, you could in isolation go, well, you know, without Lacazette, without Aubameyang, they're missing key attacking personnel. But it's clear from these stats and the conversation we're having, this is a recurrent theme. And your point about luck is a really interesting one. I mean, I don't, you know, I'm not a great subscriber to kind of things being fated or even kind of sort of refereeing conspiracies or anything like that. But, and maybe I'll take pelters for this because I know people think that I'm sort of, you know, protective of Mikel Arteta, which isn't really the case at all. I do think he does seem to be quite an unlucky guy as a manager. And actually, maybe, like, maybe that is a thing. Like, maybe it really matters to get the breaks and it feels like he doesn't.
Well, look, he's had so much to contend with in the 18 months or whatever it is that he's been manager coming up on 18
months. I include
that. You know.
Yeah, in my assessment of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The list of obstacles and problems that he's faced, and then you look at kind of the errors and the refereeing decisions and the VAR decisions and things like that. He must, you know, he must have run over a few black cats or something in his time. Smashed a few mirrors. I don't know.
I know. And then we come back to the same story about how, well, you know, you make your own luck and all that kind of stuff, you know?
True.
The was it Gary Player quote that we did a couple of weeks ago, the more I practice, the luckier I get, you know? And there's some truth to that too, in that, like, if we were having all these things go against us, but we were able to score, you know, a couple of goals a game on average, you know, we'd be in a much better position right now. It's not to say we would have won every game. Some of the decisions would still have gone against us. We would have dropped points along the way, but not as many. So it comes back to, I think this is now a hallmark of Arteta's management, in as much as we can make judgments on it in a short period of time. And we only have Arsenal to go on. We don't have his managerial career anywhere else to say, well, this is not who he is, or this is not what he does. But, you know, this inability to score goals. We're a shot-shy team, a creation-shy team, and a goal-shy team. And after, you know, a fairly reasonable period in charge, having had some moments along the way where we've thought, okay, we've cracked it, this is what we want to do, this is how we're going to do it, etc., we kind of revert to the mean, you know, to who we are at the core of us under Mikel Arteta. And it's a problem that he is going to have to get on top of very quickly. Otherwise, I think he's going to be in big trouble, if he's not already, you know. And I know he is for some people, but, you know, I'm talking about the view the club might have, as opposed to the view that sections of the fan base who are far from convinced already have.
Yeah, that's it. And I think ultimately that's kind of what I mean about maybe we don't talk about results enough at times. I do think sometimes you have to step back and look at it starkly. You know, if you really go into every game, you can kind of find a narrative within each game of, you know, why it went wrong and why there's an explanation. Mm. But ultimately, if you're not winning, it's a big, big, big problem.
Yeah.
And I mean, something's been true of this Arsenal team pretty much since Arsene Wenger left, is that it's felt like games have hinged on narrow margins, right? And I just think that speaks to the fact that we are, I heard Clive on Twitter described it as a pack. We're part of a pack of teams where the games are kind of very close. You know, we don't do enough to separate ourselves from that pack. You know, we're not doing what Man City are doing. We're not doing what even the likes of Liverpool and people like West Ham are doing in terms of sort of, you know, chances they're creating versus chances they're conceding. Our games are kind of close enough that if a call does go against you, it's probably costing you 3 points, as it did on Friday. And, you know, that's the trouble. We're a long way away from being a dominant team, and that ultimately does have to be the manager's responsibility. It's a maybe it's just because Thursday is looming and I think everyone's mindful of what a big tie that is for Mikel Arteta. But it does feel like... and maybe it's just because everyone's very pissed off about everything that went on in the week with the club more generally. But it does feel like there's been a slight swing in his popularity, shall we say, this week.
Yeah, downturn, I guess.
Yeah.
Look, let's talk about the two big moments in the second half. I think the first one, I would deal with them chronologically because, you know, I think it is important. The penalty decision... and then the subsequent overturning of that decision. You know, when we talk about luck and, you know, not getting things going for you, look, I just want to be clear. I am not blaming VAR for our result on Friday night. I'm not blaming VAR for our results this season, our performance, anything. But... it's really, really difficult not to be hugely frustrated by the way it is being used, the sort of fiddly bollockery that it comes up with to find any reason whatsoever to deny a goal or to chalk off a goal-scoring opportunity or a goal itself. Like, it's ludicrous, isn't it, that decision should be given... nobody in their right mind would even have noticed that. If it was a normal game with no VAR and that penalty was given, Everton fans, and I think quite rightly, could have been complaining about how soft the decision was to award a penalty for that kick, right?
Yeah.
We spoke about it.
Yeah, I would say so.
We spoke about it after the Fulham game, and I thought that was a very, very soft penalty. But, you know, if that... the Fulham one is a penalty, then why shouldn't we get a penalty for something the exact same? But I think Everton fans would have been well within their rights to complain about that being soft. It's the classic, well, there's contact, but contact, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We've fucking done this to death 1,000 times. But nobody in the world would have said, well, the reason this goal or this goal-scoring opportunity should be disallowed is because 15 seconds previously, Nicolas Pepe's elbow appeared to be offside in the build-up. Nobody would have said that. So what is VAR doing to the game? It's just nonsense.
No, and I have to be... I'm pretty consistent in that I don't even really like it when it goes for us. I just think that some of the decisions are... completely absurd and arbitrary. It really feels arbitrary with this line drawing. And Dale Johnson, who is the kind of VAR czar on Twitter, he pointed out that one of the major issues here is the inconsistency because there's no clear guidance on whether or not those lines get drawn. So some video system referees will decide... that offside is actually so close that if we draw the lines, it will be problematic and we shouldn't do it. So he made the case that with a different VAR, a different video system referee, we probably never reach that point. It's at their discretion whether they do it or not. When they do it, it's such a flawed system because A, you've got the lines which are working off imperfect camera angles, which are not, it's not technology created for that purpose. You know, it's they're working from TV cameras to try and find out a solution. Then you've got the fact that you have to, you're literally using a frame of the film. But is that the perfect frame where the ball actually leaves the foot? I mean, that aspect of it gets completely overlooked often in the discussion.
Yeah.
There's just so much. And then, like you say, it's like, well, they seem to be trying to draw it from the shoulder, but half the time it looks like it's their elbow. How are they being absolutely certain about that? If you're going to be as exact as about the line itself needs to be accurate and a reflection of that kind of objectivity. I think it's really appallingly applied. I think Arsenal... listen, in my book... that shouldn't be a penalty, what happened to Danny Ceballos. But given what happened to us the previous week, I agree with you. If you want consistency, it probably is. But, yeah, the offside thing's just ludicrous. And the fact that no Everton player appeals or even looks to the linesman, you know what I mean, at that point in the game. That's the spirit of the law, right? There's no advantage being gained there. It's not sort of cheating. It's not like he's standing 5 yards offside and pulling the defensive line out of shape. It's ludicrous.
It's like the Saka one, you know, the other week where his toe was offside. And it's just, I know it, people will say letter of the law, but this particular law is a fucking ass. Well, look, there you go. And that, you know, in a game like that against Everton, I think Pepe's a good penalty taker. I think we probably go 1-0 up.
He'd already scored in my mind. I was like, that's it. He'll put that away.
There is the break that sometimes you need, or very often you need if you're Arsenal, in fairness. And we didn't get it and couldn't find a goal. And then their goal happens. Look, I know Granit Xhaka got roasted, but it's basically in the, 4 or 5 games that he's played at left back, the first time I've seen any attacker go beyond him like that. You know, he committed himself to a tackle and Richarlison skipped past him. But
there was one moment in the first half that was similar. I mean, Richarlison obviously, you know, he fancied that flank, which is kind of fair enough. But I'm with you, you know, if you've got Granit Xhaka in at left back, you know that that's a risk, right? You know that every so often he is going to get caught because he's not a left back and he's not the quickest bloke. Yeah. But it shouldn't be a disaster necessarily for a guy to get to the byline. I mean, you know, what happens from then on, it's a huge, huge error from Bernd Leno.
It's massive because it's not...
It's worst, even. I would say. Would you? I can't remember one quite as bad as that.
No, it's by far his worst moment in an Arsenal shirt. I know there was a stat doing the rounds, maybe in his first season or his second season, that he had made X amount of errors leading to a goal more than any other goalkeeper. And I you know, it didn't really tally with what I was seeing because, you know, he's a good shot stopper usually. He's saved our bacon on many occasions. But this felt like something that had been in the post for a little while with Bernd Leno, didn't it? Because I think his form has been patchy. There have been a couple of goals that have gone in where if he's not 100% at fault, he's not necessarily convincing with a couple of the saves that he could have made. And... you know, this was like if Richarlison had absolutely leathered that ball across, like if he'd whacked it across and it had skidded between the goalkeeper's legs, you can sort of say it's still a mistake, but I understand how it happened. Yeah. I've watched this one so many times, I just do not understand. Or he took his eye off the ball, lack of concentration, maybe he was looking up to see, you know, who he could throw it to quickly, whatever it is, it's an absolute howler from Leno, and I think it places Mikel Arteta, or gives him a bit of a conundrum about what to do next, you know?
Yeah, he's in a rut for sure. He's in bad form, and I think it goes back quite a few weeks now. And I think some people would say, well, there's a few chickens coming home to roost. I think people have had their doubts about Leno a little bit. I happen to think he's just in a bad vein of form, and I think that can happen with a goalkeeper. It's just slightly surprising, you know. We did see errors from him in his first season. I remember one against Chelsea where he sort of palmed a ball out and they scored the rebound. But
that was last season, wasn't it?
Was that not
last season? Yeah, the game we were winning, it was one of Arteta's first games, was it?
Yes, sorry, you're right. It was his first home game, I believe. And what has always been striking about him is how well he's recovered from them. You know, that he has made mistakes, but he seemed like an incredibly mentally strong and stable guy who invariably would then in the next game have an absolute stormer and you almost forget about it. And I think what's troubling is that he's now putting together a bit of a run of errors.
Yeah.
Stretches back to some of that bad footwork, but there have also been, I mean, you know, this goal had shades of maybe one that he conceded at West Ham in terms of getting beaten early at the near post in that fashion. This was obviously worse, more egregious.
Almunia was
Shades
looking,
of Aminga.
He was looking down from on high
with a fine glass of Rioja. Yeah. Smiling on from the roof of the Emirates Stadium. Now, I know exactly what you mean about what happens next.
Let's park that though, because I've got questions for part two, so we'll come back to that. But it is, you know, it is a huge error, and you know, ultimately one that cost us the game.
We had VAR again, by the way. We were the wrong side of the arbitrary line once more.
Yeah, exactly. It was a millimetre the right way from Everton's point of view. I mean, I was looking at the replay and I was going, oh, please, you know, this could save our bacon here. And I looked at the replay first time and I was like, how could they possibly give that offside? I know they just gave our one offside, but, you know, it's just...
When you chuck it in your own net, you can't have too many grievances. Do you know what I mean?
No. And even there, you know, that goes back to maybe some of the bad luck that if you want to ascribe that to bad luck, but certainly from a manager's perspective, you know, whatever your failings in terms of how your team performs or how proficient they are going forward, how many chances they create, et cetera, you know, that's out of your hands. Unless your goalkeeper is doing that every week and you keep picking him, then it's your problem. But, you know, a manager can't legislate for an experienced goalkeeper like Bernd Leno doing something like that.
No, I think you're right about that. I do think you could maybe ask question more broadly of the club, you know, in terms of they let Emi Martinez go for a lot of money in the summer. They didn't properly address the number two position. I don't know. I think maybe the management of the goalkeeper area, if they brought in a really credible number two in August, you know, who was sort of pushing Leno all season, or who was a really competent, confident alternative, maybe someone... I don't know. I mean, we will discuss whether or not Matt Ryan is those things. But, you know, if they had brought in another guy with Martinez's kind of stature, probably unrealistic, but maybe it changes the situation. But, you know, that let's not relitigate all that. But I think it is worth mentioning. It was a huge, huge, huge mistake.
Mm. One we couldn't put right either in terms of, you know, finding an equalizer or finding a, you know, finding a goal to save something from the game the way that we did against Fulham. I mean, we had three attempts on goal after they had scored. Yeah. You know, there was a Martinelli one, I think, and Danny Ceballos,
maybe.
Thomas
Partey.
Yeah.
What did you make, I mean, more broadly, just of the attack? I mean, we talked about maybe not creating enough. What, were you surprised that he went for Eddie Nketiah, say, over Gabriel Martinelli as the centre-forward?
I wasn't necessarily surprised.
But maybe a little bit disappointed.
Maybe a little bit disappointed. And I don't think Eddie Nketiah had a bad game, really. There were a couple of moments where... it might have fallen for him. I thought he put himself about well. He was tidy on the ball. He did some of that dropping deep that Lacazette does.
And he had scored, of course, in the previous game.
Yeah, you know, but I think what's clear with... like, I reckon if you put Eddie Nketiah into Man City's team, he'd score a lot of goals because they create the chances that he would like to tuck away. You know what I mean? I just think that in a team... which really struggles to create on a consistent basis, when you play a striker like Eddie Nketiah, who needs structure around him to be effective as a goal scorer, I just don't know that we have that. Not on any consistent level. And I think if, and this is probably something we'll talk about a bit later on as well, but if Aubameyang is not available for Thursday, even though I think he probably will be. But if he's not, I would rather see Gabriel Martinelli start up front than Eddie Nketiah. You know, it's not because I thought Nketiah was bad. I just think that this team needs, and maybe it goes against everything that Mikel Arteta wants, but it needs a little bit of maverick energy. If we can call it that, somebody who can do something unexpected. Like, Eddie won't do anything unexpected. He'll get in positions. If you give him a chance, he'll, you know, he'll tuck it away from 3 yards out because that's where he scores his goals. But beyond that, he's not curling one in from outside the box. You know, he's not going to do what Martinelli did when he had that chance laid on. You know, the sort of burst of pace in the penalty area and the ability to get a shot off when I didn't think it was there for him to do it. He's not going to do that.
He's not going to dribble.
Yeah, and that's not to be critical of him. That's just who he is. But I think, yeah, I think, look, there's nothing we can do about Everton now, but I would prefer Martinelli in the future. And I think as well, maybe there was an element of, look, Nketiah, he'd scored, reminded people he was around, and this was maybe a little bit of a shop window selection as well.
Yeah, I think it was. I think it was because from, you know, if you're thinking purely about Arsenal's future and the development of the player, I mean, Martinelli is kind of the obvious choice. And I actually thought he would play Martinelli. I know Arteta likes Nketiah and has picked him plenty, but
well, not in the last,
not of late,
not in the last four months he hasn't, you know, so no. He's thrown a guy in pretty cold as well.
Yes, very true. And I thought just generally things didn't quite click in the final third, maybe as much as they have in previous games. I mean, there were some big players missing from this performance. And I do think we have to kind of wrap all our conversation about some of these recent performances in that a little bit. People like even Odegaard, who, you know, was instrumental until he got injured. Aubameyang, Lacazette, obviously, Kieran Tierney as well, is worth mentioning. So there were key personnel absent, and I think that is affecting us. It's just difficult because we're at a really crunch period of the season now. And we're struggling for rhythm.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And it's, you know, on the one hand, you could say, well, maybe all the focus is on the Europa League, and that's understandable, and that can happen to teams. It really can, that they do, even if they, you know, as much as the manager wants to prepare them for the next game, when subconsciously you realize this game doesn't matter all that much, it can have an impact. It can have an impact. But, of course, that's a consequence of us not being higher up the table, that this game doesn't matter. That's our problem. That's our fault. That's what we've done. It's not because the game itself doesn't matter. It's that we've been so bad that the game lacked the kind of importance that it should have at this stage of a season. You know, a home game against Everton, a home game against Fulham. These are games that you should be winning because you ought to be, at the very least, you know, pushing for securing your place in the top six and then, you know, top four and everything else. So that's our problem, that these games and the focus is elsewhere. But I understand why it is, you know?
Yeah. And I think the reason it feels dispiriting, by the way, is that, you know, the league table's never really kidded us on this season. It's not like we were riding high and exceeding expectations. It's kind of always said to us, yeah, you're going to be, you're somewhere in the middle. But I think as fans, it's our instinct to kind of always see the way out, to always be like, but if we put a run together, you know, if we we've got a five game run coming up, if we could take 13 from 15 and as the season gets on and you play more games, the prospect of that happening becomes slimmer and slimmer. So I think what, you know, when we talk about the stock of the manager declining and people feeling pretty fed up about the way the team are playing, I think it's, personally, I think it's partly down to kind of the horizon is coming into view now, and we're like, oh, it is just sort of what it looked like all along.
Yeah.
The opportunity to escape our fate is slim now. It is, as we said, basically the Europa League. And still, what an opportunity. I mean, you know, what a prize,
yeah,
potentially.
Sure. Sure, but, and like even the people who would say the Europa League is all that matters right now, it doesn't mean you can take losing the way we lost to Everton and drawing the way we drew with Fulham. You can't just take that lying down. You don't just say, well, fuck it. You can't, especially in the overall context of this season where, you know, we've lost 13 games,
Failed
to score in 12 of them. You know, that is whether you think there's been improvement since Christmas or Boxing Day or whatever, that's just part of the big picture. The big picture and the overall picture is the season as a whole, and that's how you make your assessment.
Absolutely. And I mean, I still remember and think about when Arsenal finished 12th in, was it 1995, something like that. And at the end of the day, after 38 games, you will get a league position, and that will be history, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
On every graph of Arsenal's standing in English football that is plotted forever, where we end up after 38 games will be there. And we can't, it'll never have an asterisk.
That's exactly it. Is it like Arsenal, the Premier League table, Arsenal 11th?
Yeah, they weren't really trying because Europa League was there. Yeah.
Or in brackets, but...
Yeah, exactly.
However,
they got as far as the Europa League semi-finals. Well, they went out 7-0 on aggregate to Unai Emery's team. Okay. No, but it's exactly that. And I think, I think we're just sort of coming to terms with the unfortunate reality that that run that we have always said, well, if we could just do this, or we could just do that, it's probably never coming.
No. No, there's been no evidence this season that we could do... anything like that. In fairness, it was us looking at things with our glasses half full, you know, as you know, more than half full, probably three quarters full, probably overflowing, if I'm going to completely Alan Partridge this analogy, you know. it is that, though. But when you look at the results and you look at the run in the Premier League, I mean, have we had three wins in a row at all in the Premier League this season?
I have a feeling we haven't, but should we have a look?
I'm just having a look. Yeah. Chelsea, Brighton and West Brom.
So that turn of the year when it felt like we had turned some sort of corner.
That is the only time this season that we have won three Premier League games in a row. We've won, right. Yeah.
And if you look at the Premier League table, Brighton and West Brom's positions aren't too clever. Do you know what I mean? No. So it's not the kind of run to get too excited about. I mean, look, we all did. But, the results are pretty dismal.
They are.
They really are.
Hey, look. It is all about Europa League. It is all about Thursday, and that's something that we can talk about a little later in the week. We will be doing, of course, a preview podcast for the Villarreal game on Thursday. So let's talk a little bit about what happened before the game. I mean, everyone knows at this point why it happened. So do we need to go over the why or the, you know, the build-up or everything that went on in the week?
I think people are saturated with that, aren't they?
I think so, yeah. I mean, we did enough, in podcast terms last week. I think we covered all the angles on it. So I don't think we need to go over that again. But you were there, obviously, before the game. I saw your video. What was your sense of the atmosphere, the mood, I guess, and the... What the turnout showed, because it was in. I mean, look, part of me is a little bit like squicked out by it from the pandemic sense.
Yeah,
it made me personally feel uncomfortable in the sense that I would not have liked to have been there. You know, in the middle in these current circumstances. I'm not casting any judgments on anyone who was there. I fully support the protests and everything else. But just, you know, personally, it just made me feel a little bit uncomfortable from the pandemic point of view. I mean, so with feet on the ground and eyes on the scene and everything else, what did you make of it all?
I had that feeling as well because I've lived, you know, pretty carefully for more than a year. So... there was a kind of inherent caution in me, but I think you could, if you wanted to be sensible, you could be, you know what I mean? Like you could take the right precautions, keep your distance, keep your mask on. I'm not going to sit here and tell you everybody was doing that. But you know, if you wanted to, you absolutely could. Being there, the atmosphere was great. I think the turnout is obviously partly about everything that's gone on this week and how strongly people feel about that. I think it is also a little bit of a you know, we're at a time in England now where, rightly or wrongly, people feel that we are the other side of the mountain in terms of the pandemic, and there's a real desperation and an urge to feel that sense of community. And I think that fed into the turnout. Yeah. I think people wanted to be part of a group, wanted to be part of something. And I can't lie to you, it was very exciting to see and witness and hear that. And football fans, you know, there's always going to be that kind of black humour attached to it, which I think there was a lot of that. But also it was very good natured, and the police seemed to handle everything pretty well, from what I could tell. The other emergency services were down there, the ambulances. It was all pretty, there was good rapport with everybody. And I think it was just a powerful statement, really. I mean, the rest of the football world was watching. You know, every other Premier League team, there were some fans from other Premier League teams there, I should say. I saw United fans, Liverpool fans, I saw a Leicester fan. But every other Premier League team was watching the coverage of that. And I had a lot of messages, actually, from people in football or just fans saying how excited and grateful they were to see, you know, supporters taking a stand in this way. So it felt brilliant to be part of it. And I mean, look, you've seen all the pictures, you've seen all the original funny signs people came up with.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, some brilliant the way ones. Yeah, the way in which fan culture kind of expresses itself is great. And I just thought it made me yearn for normality and getting those fans back in the stadium too. That was the overriding thing. I think, you know, we've really learned this year how important supporters are to the game, and certainly to my enjoyment of the game as a live spectacle. And I really thought, you know, this is what we've been missing. And
how was it? Can I ask you? I was just going to ask you, because to me it looked quite, there was something, it was like a cup final or something outside in terms of, you know, the atmosphere and the way people were there. Maybe it's because we're just not used to it. So what was it like, you know, as somebody who's been lucky enough to go to games this season and work at games? You know, normally you're ambling in and there's always people around the stadium and stuff like that, but never in the last year in those kind of numbers. So you're used to going in to an empty stadium, working in an empty stadium, et cetera, et cetera. So what was it like leaving that thronging mass of Arsenal fans, Arsenal community, as you say, all together to protest against the owners? And maybe we'll we'll have some more broad questions on that in part two. But to sort of go from something that we associate so easily with football is, you know, the crowd, the noise, the singing, the jokes, the all of it. People shoulder to shoulder, all of that kind of stuff, and then going into an empty stadium. Because you could hear some of it outside on the
TV.
Yeah,
it was surreal.
You know?
It was surreal. It was a bit of a come down, as you can imagine. It was kind of like, it really did feel more empty than ever, that stadium. And, you know, even around the kind of outside of it, you know how they have banners from fans that are designed and that kind of hang all around. I don't know what you would call it, but they hang around sort of the stands, essentially. And a good few of them had been taken down because Arsenal fans had followed Liverpool's lead and a lot of them had asked for their banners to be removed. And that added again to that kind of slightly surreal feeling of emptiness. And actually, there was a moment I nipped out during the first half into the kind of exterior concourse bit where you've got, you know, the sort of, you'd ordinarily have like the burger stands and drink stands. And obviously it's completely empty. It's just sort of grey concrete. But at that point, the police, I think, had moved the fans away from the club shop and they were all walking round the exterior of the stadium. So you were in this empty, hollow, echoing corridor, but you could hear the fans, the other side of the turnstiles, singing songs and chanting and, you know, laughing. And it was this very odd contrast of this, you know, cold, hollow, empty stadium and really the life and soul of football being just outside it. It was a real contrast and you really felt it more plainly than ever. And actually, I think in the little bits and pieces I've picked up from what Mikel Arteta said about it all in press conferences, I sense that his biggest frustration, and it's one of mine certainly, is that Arsenal fans coming back to the Emirates Stadium should have been such a wholly joyous occasion,
yeah,
an event. And it should have been so about togetherness and unity. And obviously, everything that's gone on in the past 7 days or so has really damaged and compromised that.
Mm.
And it's such a shame. And it, the fans are absolutely right, by the way, to protest. But it's such a shame that something that should have been really about positivity and togetherness, and it was still about that from a supporters' perspective, but it should have been about the whole club, will never quite have that now, I don't think. And when the fans come back in the stadium, I'm sure the anger and the dissent that we saw on Friday will still be there.
That is an interesting way to look at it all, right? I mean, I suppose you would say that it is a positive thing that fans are together,
yes,
and they're united and they, you know, I don't think necessarily that the Super League, this was a protest against Stan, against KSE, but it was not simply because of our involvement in the Europa or in the Super League, right?
No, I mean, that was over by this point.
Yeah, you know, it was, okay, fans wanted to make clear their objection to it and the sense that this had been damaging to the club and to the reputation of the club, and our involvement was an embarrassment and it was shameful and all of those kind of things. But this has sort of been a long time in the process, I think, hasn't it? That, you know, there have been sporadic anti-Kroenke and KSE protests. Go on.
Yeah, I was just going to say, yes, you're right. This would always have come to the surface sooner or later because there's always been that sentiment underlying. All I mean, and it is absolutely positive that there is that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I know what you mean. Like, you were saying that, like, the return of the fans should be the gates are open, everybody floods back in, we can watch our team again, and this is a happy moment for everybody. It's not to say
an amnesty, you know? Like, there should have been... the owners and the club shot themselves in the foot because they would have been afforded, I think, a bit of an amnesty. Such would have been the excitement for everyone to be back together. But the nature of what they've done has killed that for them. And you know, I'm really fascinated to see. I think the supporters will still absolutely be behind the team, and we will still see a bit of a lift there when we get the fans back. But... yeah, it's just interesting, isn't it? It's kind of not how... It was great, but it was also not how I imagined it the first time you get a couple of thousand Arsenal fans together.
Mm. What do you think will the reaction be from the ownership, from KSE?
Yeah.
It's so hard to... It's so hard to know, isn't it? You know, Josh Kroenke, whether you... take what he said at face value or otherwise, did appear at this fans forum meeting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that any of the other owners have graced their own fans with an appearance, albeit on Zoom or whatever. So, you know, I just don't quite know what to make of it, in the sense that it's hard for me to like, I wanted to give them the benefit of the doubt to an extent after the We Care Do You thing, and he came out and he spoke and he was more communicative and all of that kind of stuff, and you think, well, maybe like a little corner has been turned. Their eyes have been fully opened to the sentiment that the fans have, and from there they can build an uneasy truce, a rickety bridge, whatever you want to fucking call it. But like, here's what we said, and you responded, and that's like, if not quite an olive branch, right? It's, I don't quite know how to explain this. I just sort of had some hope
that they would have
learned from that a bit. But here we are, whatever it is, like nearly 2 years on from the We Care Do You thing. And Josh is in the thing, in the meeting, saying, yes, we never had any trust. We know we never had any trust. But why don't you do anything about that? You know,
well, I think what he actually said, I think, is that he said the little bit of trust
has been shredded.
Yeah, that he'd started to win back. And I know for some people, they absolutely have always hated everything about Stan Kroenke and KSC and their ownership of the club. And that's perfectly, I mean, they'll feel very vindicated in that opinion right now. But I do think that you could have constructed a case that after they took sole ownership in 2018, you know, there had been the kind of coming together of the Weekend Do You thing. There were a couple of other little things that made you think, okay, we don't know the terms, but they have refinanced the stadium debt. You know, we don't know the terms, but we somehow 50 million euros for Thomas Partey turned up, right?
Mm.
So there were enough things that made you think, maybe we're getting somewhere. And I actually thought that was the most powerful, you know, I don't know if powerful is the right word, but the most telling maybe moment of everything Josh Kroenke said in that fans forum, the recognition that any goodwill that they had managed to construct, they have shredded. I mean, they are back at, not at zero, they are back in a minus at this point by a big way. And like how stupid, how frustrating and how foolish, you know, they had such an uphill climb, and the fact they made any ground at all took probably quite a lot of work and probably quite a lot of money, and they've chucked it away. It is kind of extraordinary. And it's really hard, you know. It was great, the protest, and I was lucky in that, like, you know, even through my mask, a few people were like, ah, gonna block James, you know. And the only question people would ask was, so what's going to happen? And I've got to be honest, Andrew, I didn't know what to tell them, because I loved what I saw from the Arsenal fans, but I'm also a realist, you know, and I know how difficult and maybe improbable change might feel. But you don't want to tell people that in the middle of the, you know, a sort of day of jolly protesting.
Sure, yeah.
And you want to be wrong as well. But, yeah, it's really hard to, you know, come back to your original question, where what will it lead to? What sort of reaction will we get from the owners? I suspect we will get things like Josh turning up at a fans meeting, and you know, when he's allowed to travel and everyone's allowed to travel, more in-person engagement at that kind of event, you know, maybe we'll see a few. I mean, to be fair, pre-pandemic he was at a lot of games, he'll probably be at a lot of games again, but what does that really mean? I mean, what does that really count for? Like, I know fans want it. It's a token, though, isn't it?
Well, it is and it isn't. It is and it isn't. Because I think the one thing that you could, without any hesitation, accuse KSE of since they took over, like, you know, there has been money to spend. Money has been spent. I know it's the club's money and everything else, but money has been spent on players, on contracts.
We spend a lot of money on transfers, yeah. I think.
And
last few windows,
and
we spend money.
And renewing big contracts for big players. You know, we've put the...
Too much, some would say.
Right. But what I would say their biggest issue has been, regardless of their inability to connect, and like... Yeah. I don't know that it's necessarily possible for Stan Kroenke to connect with Arsenal fans, dyed-in-the-wool... No. Old school, old fashioned Arsenal fans, like, he's got no concept of who they are. And, you know, his life is so far removed from all of ours. You know, we know he's a billionaire, but like, yeah, it's just completely different. But the point I'm making is that I think the big criticism since their inception or since their arrival has been, or since they had some control and influence, I should say, has been absenteeism. The sense that the owner is disconnected from the club.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I didn't expect Stan Kroenke to do a John W. Henry video. I'm sorry. No, he's not.
No, I'm actually... I'll say this. I'm glad he didn't.
I'm glad he didn't either. I don't want to hear that, because I know it's absolute bullshit.
Exactly.
But I suppose the difference is that... Henry's apology as mealy-mouthed and all the rest of it as it was, came from a guy who had been present for pretty much the entire time, you know, that they've been there at Liverpool. He has been a figurehead. Stan has been over there and has let people run the club for him, and that's the way he works and everything else. The issue, of course, is who he allows to run the club and what they can do or what they do or how they do it, etc., etc. So I think it was just another step backwards towards that sense of absenteeism. And Josh being at games, maybe it's a token, but maybe if you're around, you learn stuff. You find out what's happening. You know who's good. You know what people are talking about. You know, like, you know, whatever relationship you have with somebody over WhatsApp or FaceTime is completely different when it's face-to-face.
Yeah, of course.
You know? So I do think there is a need for the people who are in charge of the ultimate decisions being taken at your football club to be there, to understand. You know, we know they don't come from a football background. They come from a sports franchise background, and that's part of why they wanted to be involved in a Super League, because I think that would have just made life easier for them, because they wouldn't have to learn anything. They don't have to learn how football works or how fandom works or what's expected or all of those things, because if you just get into this, and I'm going to use the word Americanized, and I don't mean it pejoratively. I just mean that is what they're used to, and that's what this Super League idea was, that makes life really easy for them, because they don't have to worry about the nuts and bolts of football or competitiveness or making a team that works. So I think, again, you know, I'm not hopeful, but if, and I know the pandemic has played some part in this as well, right? Because, you know,
that's
travel
played
is
some part,
but you know, it's not that- Yeah, it's not.
Listen, we're all on Zoom, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, that explains why Josh isn't at games. It doesn't explain why, as he said in the meeting the other day, he hasn't been able to engage with fans. That's not valid.
Yeah, even that, though. You know, I wonder about that, you know, in because I think we look for engagement from the owners, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with looking for it either. And I know one of the things that came up during the fans forum was fan representation on the board.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
There's a reason why that is something that we're looking for. And it's because, A, there is a lack of understanding from the people who own the club. So we, as fans, feel like, well, we could fill that gap because we know, even though, like, you could put 20 Arsenal fans in a room and in 5 minutes they'd be arguing about something, you know what I mean?
Sure.
They'd find something to argue about. But, you know, I think that's part of it, is this sense that if they don't know what it is, we do. Fundamentally, we know, so we could be that. But the second most important point is that we just don't have good enough people on the board in the first place. So I don't necessarily want, this isn't to shoot down the idea, but I don't necessarily want fan involvement on the board or fan representation on the board. I want the best people that we can get to run this football club on the board. Do you know what I mean? So it's like,
but what's interesting is, and that this is one of the most interesting things about the protest. I think there was clear consensus on Kroenke out, but I don't think there is necessarily consensus among the Arsenal fans about what exactly we want. Do you know what I mean? Like, are a lot of people who would say to you, "Well, we do want fan representation on the board."
Sure. I like, but all I'm saying is that if we had highly skilled football executives on the board, this football club would probably be in a better position. And the need, or this thing that we feel we need, like if we were winning trophies, nobody would care if there was a fan on the board or not. And ultimately,
that's
what it comes down to.
That's very true.
Like, with the best will in the world, the biggest Arsenal fan in the world could be on the board, it's not going to make any real difference because there's no influence there. They might be somebody who can provide some background or some color or say, well, look, if you do this, this is the way fans are going to react. And I'm not saying that that's not that couldn't be useful. But the reality is we want this because this club is it's going backwards. We all felt like we needed to maybe take a step backwards before we went forwards again, but we're going a bit too far backwards. So we're panicking in a way because we can see that the trajectory is the wrong trajectory. So how can we fix it? We want to be involved. But I would, you know, I think ultimately it boils down to having the best people available. And that's like at board level and picking the team and, you know, being technical director and all of those kinds of things.
Yeah. I think there are two sides to it all, really. There's the politics and there's the performance, you know, and I think different fans, there's kind of a scale between those of sort of where you sit in terms of what it is that you want from change. I think, you know, I think probably the majority are much more led by performance. If Arsenal start winning things, that will appease them. I think there are other fans for whom this is much more about the political side, fan representation, you know, ownership structures.
Oh, yeah.
Now, maybe there is a correlation between those two things. Maybe one would, you know, maybe fan involvement would lead to more success. I don't know.
I don't want to be make it sound like I'm dismissive of the idea of fan involvement or anything like that. I mean, I think, you know, there's been a lot of talk, hasn't there, of the 50+1model that they have in Germany. And I think, you know, football, particularly in England, opened the door to allow people in. So situations like this at football clubs were going to happen, you know?
How do you explain to someone who spent, you know, whatever it is that the Kroenke spent to acquire Arsenal, actually, you now don't have majority voting
rights? Well, I don't know how that's possible, you know, in any, like, how is it even legally possible to say to somebody, we are completely changing the landscape of, well, like, this is basically company ownership. That's what it is like, we can talk about it applying to football or whatever, but, you know, these are basically companies. It's company law. So,
and I love that model, by the way. Listen, if someone said you can click your fingers and, you know, suddenly 50% plus one votes on all major issues belong to the fans, effectively, fantastic. Wow, what an incredible thing to have. And credit to German football for preserving it in as far as they have done this far. I don't see that at all being feasible in the Premier League. No. I don't wish to sound cynical. I just don't know how the hell that would work.
Well, I mean, before we take a break for part two, you know, Barcelona as a football club elects its president. You know, it's the socios that make the decisions about who's in charge, and they're currently €1 billion in debt. So fan involvement isn't always... Now, I know that's down to, you know, what's gone on there, but it's not like a panacea for everything that's wrong either, you know?
No, and I know we're overdue a break, but, you know, the conversation's sort of flowed. So what I would say is they're not engaged enough, the Kroenkes, but then is that not absolutely inevitable when Arsenal aren't your sole focus? Arguably not even the jewel in the crown, you know? I mean, the Rams are a huge focus for them. Running a football club, owning a football club is such a consuming, huge project from a business perspective, from a passion perspective. If you are like an umbrella company that owns half a dozen teams, it's absolutely inevitable, is it not, that you're not going to dedicate as much focus to one as we would like.
Well, I mean, and look, here's the other thing, the final thing that I'll say on this before we go and take a break, is that, you know, as fans, I think we're right to be distrustful of Kroenke, or indeed maybe any other owner that comes in or would have come in, because when it boils right down to it, football and profit from football clubs is a pittance. If you make a profit, it's just, it's measly in comparison to what you're making as a billionaire from your other investments, right?
Yeah.
It's tiny. So where do you extract the value? And it is by manipulating the game and maneuvering to make something like the Super League happen. So the asset,
the value of your investment. Yeah.
So, you know, the motives for their involvement ultimately are completely flawed for me, unless you have the passion for the football club. Like if it's an Arsenal supporting billionaire that comes along and all he wants, like you or I or anyone listening to this, if we had a, you know, £5 billion tomorrow, you buy Arsenal and you do everything you could to make it the best thing in the world that it could be, right? But why would you do that if you were Stan Kroenke or someone who just wanted to own a football club for whatever reason?
And I just don't believe there are meant. There are some, but I don't believe there are many people who end up with £5 billion who make habits of giving it all away.
Well, I would. If I had £5 billion tomorrow, James, I would spend some fucking money on this football team. I promise you that.
How much of your five billion?
Well, I give what does Stan want to buy it? $2 billion. There you go. Still got $3 billion. Stick a, you know, $500 million into the transfer budget in the first season. That should you know, get us a few decent players.
And you'll be all right with just that?
Just the $2.5 billion
that you're left?
Yeah.
What can I say? You're just a selfless guy, I guess.
I know.
A man of the people.
Let's
have...
Kroenke out, Andrew in. Just need the $5 billion.
Let's draw an arbitrary VAR-like line in this podcast at this point. No one knows why it's happening now. No one's sure if it's exact. We'll just do it now and then move into part two.
Let's do it.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome back to part two of the Arscast Extra. This is where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at Gunnarblog and at Arsblog, and also on the Arsblog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an Arsblog member on Patreon. I'm going to go first, James, returning to something that we discussed in part one, a couple of them here. Ash Richards 90 from the Discord says, is it time to give Matt Ryan a go in goal? It's obvious Leno has issues with concentration, literally had nothing to do on Friday, and then that happened. And Saul Goodman, LMK, says, evening, gents. Leno's blunder the other evening was awful. He's been very inconsistent and doesn't instill much confidence in me, even when he's on form. Is it time to seriously consider Matt Ryan for the moment and maybe look into the market in the summer, especially with the comments Leno made only a couple of weeks ago?
It's a really big decision, I think. You know, you've got a player who is in bad form. And if it was an outfield player, I think you would drop him.
Yeah.
But for some reason with a goalkeeper, maybe as well because Matt Ryan, while he's a very credible international goalkeeper, maybe he sort of, he was never the plan, shall we say. Maybe he's not got the, you know, had we bought David Raya last summer and he was sat there on the bench and the goalie coach loves him and Arteta thinks he's perfect fit for the style and all that stuff, you know, it's an easier decision than putting in the guy we loaned from Brighton because he wasn't playing. You know, there's a... it feels like more of a gamble. But of course, sticking with Leno is a gamble, given the run that he's on. I personally would go Leno. I just think and you know what? I don't know enough about Matt Ryan to make that call.
I think that's at the heart of it for me. Like I would be tempted, but you know, I think if you make that decision on Leno now, you're basically ending his season. You're saying that right from now on, Matt Ryan is the goalkeeper. So Matt Ryan is going to play, if you pick him on Thursday, got to play him in the Premier League as well, I think. You know, because goalkeepers, you don't want to be in and out with goalkeepers. You want to, let him build some form, I guess, if you're going to continue to do what you need to do in the Europa League. So if you drop Leno for this, you're saying, right, that's season over. And like you, I don't know quite enough about Matt Ryan. I think he's been okay in the two games you've seen him. He's obviously experienced. It is a difficult one, though, because you're right. If Leno was an outfield player right now, he wouldn't be playing in this kind of form. Goalkeeper is a different position, though. It is a special position as well, so it's not quite the same thing.
No, it's different with good reasons. Yeah, I understand why it's not the same. And you don't, rotate your goalkeepers and stuff. But I sort of come back to what I say in part one here. I think sort of we're in a slightly awkward position of, the number two that we have. And again, I don't mean to be harsh on Matt Ryan. I liked him when he was at Brighton, and I think he's done well in the games that he's played. But it still feels like a gamble of sorts. I mean, has he been tested at this level? Has he played a European semi-final? I don't know.
Yeah, like it's a headache he could have done without, to be fair. You know, considering the other headaches that he has to contend with Tierney, with Louise out, with, question marks over the strikers.
I think he'll definitely go Leno, by the way. I mean,
I think he will as well.
There's a debate, but knowing what we do with Arteta, I think he's going Leno.
What do you think of the Leno situation overall? Because, look, we're all...
Weird comments, weren't there, the other day?
Yeah, we're all brilliant at reading between the lines. And we're all brilliant at jumping to a conclusion about something and then, like, a few days later, it turns out to be completely wrong. But that's what we do as football fans, and it's part of the enjoyment.
Do a podcast.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But do you have any doubts or worries or concerns about Leno's... what's going to happen with him? Because it feels like we've got a lot to do in the summer. I think everyone says that. And I'm not sure too many people would have said goalkeeper is right near the top of the list of things that we have to do. However, the comments weren't exactly, I love it here, I want to stay, I want to commit my future to this club, I believe we're going places, etc., etc. It wasn't that. He basically said, I'm open to anything. Like, I'll stay or I'll go. You know, you can read a lot into that. And I don't know if you've heard anything about this, but there have been some suggestions that maybe the goalkeeping coach and Leno aren't quite on the same wavelength as well. So what's your reading on his situation and what might happen in the summer?
Well, he's at a crucial point, isn't he? Because he's 2 years out and Arsenal have to make him an offer to stay, really, if they want to keep him, I think. And maybe he's doing a bit of positioning. I don't know that for sure, but maybe there's a degree to which he's saying, well, my future is an open book. Let's see what you're prepared to put down in the contract. It is an interesting one. I also feel like, is any player super committed to play for Arsenal right now? I mean, looking at where we are in the league and sort of how far away we are from where we want to be. I'm not absolving any of these players of their part in it, but I suspect that there's quite a few of them who think, well, if a Champions League club wanted to come in for me,
yeah,
I'd be out of here like a shot.
not sure there's that many players at Champions League clubs will be sniffing around. Or,
but
you know,
I wonder if Leno might be one. I wonder if he might be one. You know, if he has enough stock in Germany or elsewhere, that he might be one.
He is what, the second or third choice goalkeeper for Germany? Is he third?
Yeah. He might not be a kind of, you know, might not quite be an Edison or, you know, an Alisson, but I think he's held in high regard internationally. So that might be in his thoughts. And he's probably thinking, if I want to have any chance of being Germany's number one, I need to be in the top European competition. I know people who don't like Leno will be saying, well, we'd stand a better chance if he didn't make all these errors. And that's absolutely right. Mm. But I just am speaking from his perspective, if he might think he's got a bit of leverage there. I don't know what's going to happen with it. You know, we needed to buy a goalkeeper last summer. We didn't manage it. We've got Matt Ryan in. He's done nothing wrong, really, so far. Beautiful pre-assist the other day.
Yeah.
But I don't think anyone's operating under any illusions that he's going to be the number one.
No.
At any point.
No.
So it's a position that needs a bit of a shake-up. Yeah. And as for the goalie coach, I mean, after... Sounds harsh to call it the Runarsson debacle, but I mean, it kind of was.
Where is
a
he?
A little bit.
Where is Runarsson?
So someone took him out to the woods near London Colney.
Just left him there, tied to a tree. This poor little Icelandic guy. So cold.
I mean, it was weird because we were even trying to get him out on loan. We couldn't manage that in January. So, yeah, I don't know if we're ever going to see that guy again. But, yeah, given that, I mean, I wouldn't be giving him free reign to pick whoever he wants in the summer.
No.
It is an interesting one, Leno. I mean, personally, I'm one of the people who rates him slightly more highly than others. I probably would give him a new deal. I don't think he's our biggest problem. But if he is well regarded and you could sell him and get someone for cheaper and it enabled you to strengthen other areas of the pitch, I could live with that as well.
Yeah, and look, the Emi Martinez thing keeps coming up as well. I suppose the bottom line there is...
Ship sail?
Ship sail. But it wasn't like we had to decide which goalkeeper we wanted to sell, because nobody was bidding for Leno, as far as we know.
No.
Martinez was kind of available.
I was chatting to an agent about this the other day, and I was sort of saying, you know, oh, they sold Martinez as well. And the agent made the point to me, Arsenal got at the time, a really good deal for Emi Martinez. Like, for a guy who'd been a number two or sometimes mostly number three goalkeeper until the age of, like, 28, and then had a couple of good months, to get 20 million quid, which is sort of the total of what they got, including add-ons, it was very difficult to turn that down if you had another goalkeeper who could play. So he's had a really good season with Aston Villa, and it makes you sort of think, ooh, did we do the right thing? But it was a good offer and a good fee. It's not one of those situations where, like, we let his contract run down and we lost him for nothing. Do you know what I mean?
Mm, for sure.
And maybe we didn't foresee Leno having the run of poor form he's having. I mean, he's definitely struggling at the moment. So to conclude, I would stick with him. With some fear in my heart.
Yeah.
What about you?
I think that's what will happen. He'll stick with Leno. I mean, what was, I suppose, most worrying about the... We talked about this a few weeks ago in terms of how many minutes he's played this season. Like, he's up there with maybe more than anyone. But he got a rest for the Fulham game. And I think it was, in part, it wasn't necessarily a physical rest that he needed. I think it was just look, we do have another goalkeeper at this club. And, you know, be aware that he could play. And it was to try and just give him a little rest to refocus him and everything else. And then that error happens after that, where you expect him to be super focused. And he wasn't. You know, it was a lack of focus. He has played more minutes than any other player this season, you know. So while it's not the most physically exhausting, it is a mentally draining to play those minutes. So sometimes you need to be taken out of the firing line. And, yeah, that was the worrying part. But anyway, we'll see. I think it will be Leno on Thursday.
German goalkeeper away to Villarreal, what could go wrong? You know, there's good precedent there.
Yes, yes.
What about this question? Sam, who is on Twitter, he's at Mighty Mongoose 7, which feels like a cartoon that needs to be made, Mighty Mongoose. Arteta has, for me, always had until December to get us playing better. Don't know why he's picked that. I guess it's...
I guess because it's... No, I would imagine that it is a, in inverted commas, normal off-season.
Ah.
Transfer window, proper pre-season, et cetera, et cetera. And then you get to December. So season starts in August. You've got August, September, October, November, December. So you've got 5 months to assess the work he's done in what would be considered, generally speaking, normal circumstances. So that's my take on that. Yeah.
But, Sam says, if we get knocked out by Unai and lose the majority of our remaining Premier League fixtures, could you see a change being made in the summer? Especially, he adds, with all the pressure on the club.
Yeah.
We spoke about this on text, didn't we? Could the pressure on the club make Arteta more vulnerable?
Yes, that's what we were talking about. I think that is true. It's, you know, if one of the criticisms of the ownership has been their reactiveness or lack of, you know, hands-on or not being proactive enough, if your manager leads you to a record season of losses in the Premier League, a record low in points, a record low in goals scored and all that kind of stuff, and you fail to get the team into Europe, if you fail to get beyond, you know, a team managed by the manager they previously sacked, like I do think that that leaves him much more vulnerable than he would have been if all this hadn't happened. Like, if the Super League stuff hadn't happened, if the Kroenke protest hadn't happened, I would have said with almost near certainty that whatever happened between now and the end of the season, whether people agree with it or not, I'm not saying that's the issue. It's what I think the club would have done would be to continue to back Arteta and to do the business that he wanted to do, or as much of the business that he wanted to do in the summer to get the team that he wants to get, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But I do believe that because of everything that's gone on, he is, yeah, his position is much less secure. He's on more shaky ground, I think.
I think so. Like, you're absolutely right. Their plan was always, or has been for some time, let's give Arteta and Edu absolute authority and control and trust. But if you're in a situation where one of the things your ownership is being criticised for is maybe a lack of alacrity in how you respond to situations, being slow off the mark, maybe being too accepting of mediocrity, it's perhaps inevitable that you will seek to kind of provide an antidote to that through action. And the most dramatic, transformative action an owner can have on the fortunes of a football team is to change the manager. I do think it puts him on slightly shakier ground.
I mean, the ground is shaky anyway, considering the record. And like, I'm
if he goes
what
out,
what was the name of Europe. The what was the name of the guy who asked the question?
Mighty Mongoose.
Sam. Sam.
But I prefer if we could refer to him as Mighty Mongoose.
He will forever now be Sam the Mighty Mongoose.
Yeah.
I was sort of inclined to take his position in that I you know...
Give him till Christmas.
Yeah.
Then sack him.
Well...
Merry Christmas, Mikel.
Well, look, if nothing improves, because I do recognise that, you know, that there have been issues and external issues for him to deal with, Arteta, I mean, that have
apparently
been...
there was a pandemic. Someone mentioned a pandemic.
Yeah, look, I'm not even necessarily talking about that, even though that is huge. I don't think you can escape it, but it's been the same for everyone. Everyone has had to deal with the pandemic. Not every club has had to deal with the departure of a legacy manager a complete restructuring of the executive, the firing of another manager, a head coach, you know, an executive structure that fell apart where, you know, there were question marks about what we were doing and how we were doing it. A lot of long-standing internal problems with the squad and everything else that have had to have been sorted out. We saw some of that happen in January with players being paid to literally just fuck off. You know, I do think there is an element of you know, Arsenal are not the same as every club. The circumstances, everyone's had to deal with COVID. Not everyone has had to deal with the departure of Wenger, the hiring of Emery, the leaving of Gazidis, the leaving of Mislintat, the, you know, Sanjehi, the malign influence of super agents on some of the business that we've been doing, poor squad building, all of those things. So the one thing that sort of gave me hope and optimism and, you know, put me very much on Arteta's side was, and remains to an extent, his acknowledgement of the problems that we have that needed to be sorted out, right? I don't think anyone can really argue with that. The problem is that you have to sort out all those things and produce results. And I do wonder if the big mistake, not the big mistake, but if it was a mistake to make Mikel Arteta manager rather than leave him as head coach and bring in, we should have brought in maybe somebody with more football experience or executive experience or technical director experience or sporting director experience, et cetera, to actively take charge of some of the things that Arteta himself appears to have been, I'm not going to say distracted by, but has had to deal with, right? So maybe that's what we should have done. Ultimately, though, you cannot ignore the results. And no manager, no Arsenal manager, who loses as many games as we've lost, even with bad luck or whatever way you want to put it, and who, you know, obviously I hope this doesn't happen. I hope, you know, our season ends with huge success. And if it does, it changes the landscape completely. But if you lose that many games and play that poorly for most of the season and crash out of Europe, no, even Mikel Arteta himself, I'm sure, would tell you, it's normal that his job would be under threat.
I think so. I think, you know, we've all seen Kroenke out trending this week. I think if Arsenal go out to Villarreal, I think there'll be another Arsenal-related hashtag trending. And I think it's that pivotal for him. I do think that it's the kind of tie that if he loses it, the optics of losing to his predecessor, who was deemed not good enough,
Yeah.
That wouldn't be pretty. And I think it's the kind of result that you'll never quite unshackle yourself from. You know, I think it will be a line in the sand for some people.
Yeah.
And I take no pleasure in saying that. You know, I think he's, like you, I think he's been dealt a difficult hand.
I think his heart is in the right place. You know, when it comes to the job and what he wants to do and how he wants to do it and what he expects from the club and what he wants, the standards that he feels we should have.
He's demanding of himself, of his players and of the club. He's not one of those people who, you know, one of the issues with Emery is that he kind of sought to explain away every performance, you know, anything that went wrong. There was a lot of equivocating about it. But Arteta, he says the right things, but, you know, again, actions versus words is another matter. I do think if he doesn't make it past this stage of the competition, he's going to come under fire from supporters. Mm. I actually think if he goes out the competition at any stage, he's going to come under fire because eventually there's going to be this moment where we realise that all the ejector seats, all the parachutes, you know, have gone. And we're out of last chances to save our season.
Yeah, yeah.
And we just crash into mid-table. And I do think, as I alluded to in part one, there's a kind of a collective capability. It's our nature as fans to sort of put that off as long as there is that possibility of escape. And when that goes away, even if it is the final day of the season, look at Unai Emery. Look at, I mean, you know, I think there was the similar effect of people were flabbergasted at how we threw away the position in the league, but he always had the get out of jail card of potentially the Europa League final. And then when he lost that, and granted it was in a particular fashion, stuff absolutely tumbled on top of him and he never recovered. And I fear for Arteta in that respect. I mean, I fear he may need to win this competition, which is a tall order, with the way we're playing.
It is. Okay.
Go on.
Here's a question from Ivan Colon, who's at Ivan M. Colon 11. And he says, do you think it's time to end the experiment of Xhaka at left back? I feel that we are lacking control in midfield, and lately Partey has been imprecise with his passing. Xhaka could help bring more precision out of our central midfielders.
I've been thinking about this one. I mean, Villarreal play on their right midfield a young chap by the name of Samuel Chukwueze.
Nearly signed him.
We tried very hard, I believe, with work permit issues. 21 years old, quick, strong, skillful, tricky. A tricky player for any left back to handle. For Granit Xhaka, maybe very tricky. Especially if he wants to drive in field. I mean, that's, you know, Xhaka doesn't want to be doing that. But I think I have the concerns. I understand the reasons for the question. I think I would still stick with him. I heard Clive on Arsenal Vision mount a pretty cogent case for sort of maybe putting Gabriel in that position. And I do wonder about that. Like, I feel like he could do it. But
he could do it in the way that Xhaka does it.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
But he couldn't do it in the traditional fullback sense, I guess.
No.
And I suppose it's not something, like, if that was the confines of that particular deployment of Gabriel, like, you're not asking Gabriel to be Kieran Tierney. You're asking Gabriel to do what Xhaka does at the moment. And the thing that we would have then is Xhaka back in midfield, which gives you less Dani Ceballos, which is something that I'm okay with.
But he's doing okay, isn't he, Ceballos?
Yeah. I just find him so underwhelming.
I guess the question is he more underwhelming? Like,
but then
it's between Ceballos and Cedric, isn't it?
Yeah,
or Gabriel.
Yeah, he's being asked to do a specific role, I suppose, as well, when Xhaka is at left back.
My short answer is I think I would have to stick with Xhaka. I think that that is the option that has worked for us best thus far. What would you do?
Like, I don't really like Cedric there. I would be less inclined than Clive to use Gabriel there.
What about Alex Runarsson?
He's lost.
He's not up to anything else, as far as we know.
Lost.
Get down the woods.
Can't find him. He's gone.
Send Albert Stuhlenberg out to the woods with a torch to look for Alex Runarsson.
A piece of rope.
There's just some goalie gloves. some torn up goalie gloves.
Lock of blind hair. Here's what I think about stuff like Xhaka at left back. I think you can do it for a few games.
Yeah.
And then the limitations of it become really obvious.
Do you think we've reached that point?
I feel like we've reached that point. But then the option is Cedric, and I'm unconvinced by that as well. So it's a difficult one for Mikel Arteta. What about this from the Discord which is slightly on the same thing. It comes from Vasisht, who says, should we play Emile Smith-Rowe deeper in the Ceballos role? So what if you were to play Xhaka at left-back and play Emile Smith-Rowe deeper in the midfield to do that linking on the left-hand side with whoever plays out there?
I think you could do that. I think you could do it. I call me crazy. Okay. I think Ceballos has been all right in this role. I think he's played some of his better football for us in the last few games. Mm-hmm. He's been a bit more consistent. I'm not in a hurry to sort of swap in the kind of untested possibility of Smith Rowe in a deeper role for Ceballos right now at such a crucial point in the season. But I do think going forward, something we've seen a few times this season has kind of been Partey at the base of midfield with Smith Rowe and Odegaard either side of him. I would like to see more of that.
Mm.
And if we had a left back, I might be making the case for that. Yeah. What do you think?
I'm trying to think, like, would Smith Rowe be able to do everything Ceballos does in that role? And I think he would. Would he give you something a little different in terms of how he moves and how quickly he could circulate the ball? I think he could. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it's his ideal position, but I think the talent is there in him to do that specific job.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about it, and I was thinking maybe Smith Rowe might be squeezed out of the starting 11 on Thursday. I just wonder if Odegaard will play in the central role.
Hmm.
I think if you do have Xhaka at left back, it really helps to have a left footer like Pepe in front of him, and then Bukayo Saka on the right hand side. So, you know, you might be looking for somewhere to put Smith Rowe in.
The left could play ahead of Pepe. Wouldn't surprise me at all.
It wouldn't surprise me, but I do think there's a value in having Pepe in front of Xhaka.
Here's another one from the Discord then.
Go on.
From Mabber, who says, do you think Partey has been getting off lightly? Consistently poor on the ball for a while now, misplaces so many simple passes and takes nonsense shots. He's been a big disappointment for me, he says.
I think that's a bit harsh.
I agree.
I think Thomas Partey has an exceptionally difficult role in this team of kind of like, you are the midfield. He made more ball recoveries, I think, than any other player. And it's off against Everton, and it's often the case. I think there are moments when his passing and shooting can look a little bit raw at times. But I don't mind that, because invariably he's trying to make something happen. And I respect that in him. All that said, if I think about it as a signing more generally, how can I phrase this? When we bought Thomas Partey, it felt like, here's a really premium player and we probably got 4 years out of him. And when I look at what we've got out of him this year, factoring in the injuries and what he's had around him, it feels like a bit of a wasted year of our time with him. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the signing has quite worked out as well as everyone would have hoped. I think that's fair. I think the question, I think some of his passing has been excellent. I think there have been moments where he's been
great
sloppy and, you know,
the other
yeah,
day.
Exactly. You know, and I think he does have the ability to progress the ball through midfield that, you know, we don't necessarily get from a Ceballos. You certainly don't get it from an Elneny. The shooting, look, that's going to be a thing until he puts one top corner.
I'll say this. I don't think he'd be doing it if Mikel Arteta didn't want him to do it, because there are some great stats around. When Granit Xhaka, when Arteta came in, Granit Xhaka started taking on a lot less shots. And it was pretty instant. And Partey continues to take shots on from range. And I can only think that the coaching staff are content for him to do so.
Yeah, he's obviously much better at kicking a football in training than he is on a football pitch. What I would say, though, is this, is that at this point of our season, he would go a long, long way to repaying a significant part of that transfer fee if he were to produce two or three big performances in the Europa League akin to the one at Old Trafford.
Well, who was his best performance of the season against Manchester United?
It was. And look, I think that's... I'm not saying that he should be the one to absolutely stand up and carry the team and all that. But I do think we need him to produce some performances in the next few weeks which are above the level that he's at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, he's got his critics, but what I would say to his critics is, how do you feel if he's injured? Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, I'd
Suddenly
rather...
then.
Yeah.
I'd rather want him out
in the team. Yeah, I want him in the team. But I do also think... I understand why people are kind of disappointed with him. If they are. You know, I understand it.
Yeah, we haven't... You know, he's had his injury problems. I think he struggled for rhythm. I think...
The team is poor. Collectively.
The team is poor. Yeah. I mean, we've put a good player in a poor team and it hasn't...
Mm.
There have been games where it's been transformative, but there have been other games where that's not been enough.
And, yeah, yeah, yeah.
To come back to the ownership, I'd be fascinated to know what they think, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Go and get this player. He's going to make a big difference. I bet they're scratching their heads. But the thing is, there have been times where you can see what a good player he is. I think, you know, anyone who's watched him can see how different he is to our other midfield players. I actually think the injuries and maybe the physical side has been the biggest adaptation. And it's weird, you know, he's played in Spanish football his whole career. He's basically been in Spanish football since his mid-teens. But maybe because he's a Ghanaian international, we didn't treat him the same way as we might another midfielder coming out of La Liga. You know, maybe we sort of expected him to immediately be at Premier League intensity and physicality.
Mm.
But maybe that's not fair. This is a guy who's always played in Spain and the Premier League is different. And maybe we paid a bit for that adaptation.
Mm.
I don't know.
Okay.
But listen, I'm glad he's not injured at the moment. What about this? Jakob Romaborn. And Jakob says, how credible do you think the reports are of Daniel Ek, or previously Aliko Dangote, really wanting to buy Arsenal?
I mean, maybe they want to, but can they? Because,
yeah,
like,
interesting move from Daniel Ek, wasn't it? It's just sort of come out with that.
Was kinda. Yeah, maybe there's something more to it. Does somebody just put something like that on Twitter for the laugh? Does it just occur to him, like, oh, hey, you know what? I've got a lot of wealth. Maybe, you know what? I'd like to buy Arsenal. I'll just tweet about it. Just see, float the idea, fly that kite and see.
I enjoyed a lot of people have just tweeted out the same thing. Do you know what I mean? Word for word, the same tweet. I'd like to throw my hat into the ring, which is quite funny. But yeah, I immediately, like everybody else, Googled what he's worth. $4.4 billion.
Yeah, but that's what he's worth. Is that what he has, though?
Exactly.
Is that what he has?
And also,
it's tied up in...
He's going to, as we've proved in part one, he's going to need $2.5 billion of that.
At least.
You know.
Liquid.
To live on.
Liquid. But maybe that's what you get. Maybe you do have more cash than people think when you pay artists $0.00000001p per stream for their music.
Yeah, a few musicians I saw kicking off about that.
Yeah.
Arsenal are apparently worth $2.8 billion, according to Forbes.
So what's that in the old... Hang on, let me have a quick check here on the money markets, the old XE.com. So
$2.8 in GBP or euros for you guys, whatever you want.
I'll do it in pounds.
Do it in the old punt.
Yeah, the old punt. So just over £2 billion, just over. So I like, I can't speak to what Daniel Ek actually wants or what Dangote actually wants. Maybe they do want to buy Arsenal. The problem is that Kroenke has to want to sell. Does he want to sell? I don't think so. I don't believe so.
That was the second part of the question, which I didn't actually ask, but, you know, would he consider selling?
David Ornstein, I think, was on some TV thing today. I just saw a Twitter post, like, and, you know, they
of course he was.
they just don't want to sell.
He's not wrong. They never have really sold anything.
Yeah.
I doubt they're about to break the habit of a lifetime. As for Daniel Ek, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about that is that, you know, you immediately encounter the sort of barrier of, oh, is his business ethical? And it raises that question. I think somebody asked this on Twitter. I can't find
like
it
what?
Right
what?
Now. Arsendal says, what does the ideal billionaire owner look like?
Me. But I'm not a
billionaire. Andrew Mann. I'm not a billionaire. 5 billion. But, it's tricky, isn't it? Because, you know, you're right. But we'd probably, if he arrived like a white knight to buy Arsenal and promised to spend money on the team and win things, we'd probably all lap it up. So it's just one of those kind of impossible things, no?
Yeah, I mean, it's like if, you know, if fucking Godzilla came in tomorrow to take over Newcastle, their fans would be like, fucking brilliant. This is great. We hate Mike Ashley. This fucking Godzilla lad, he looks great. And then they bring Godzilla in and all of a sudden he's fucking rampaging around downtown Newcastle, breathing fire out of his nose, burning up the Angel of the North, and fucking, it's mayhem.
Yeah.
But you're willing to overlook all the destruction and the fire breathing and the trampling and the rampaging and the everything else because he's not Mike Ashley. So, to the wider point, though, it is difficult when you get into the kind of financial range that these people are in to come across the nicest people, you know?
There's only so many people who can buy Arsenal, who could afford it, you know? And most of them have probably done things to piss people off to make that money.
Yeah.
It's really interesting, you know, because, you know, the sort of dialectic, the big sort of discourse over the past week has been about sport versus business. You know, that's kind of how it was all framed. Super League's about sporting ambition against sort of business growth. And the teams that were last into the Super League and first out were Manchester City and Chelsea.
They don't need it, but they're not as dependent on it.
Exactly. So, and what are the reason that those people bought those clubs? Well, to make them look good, essentially.
Mm.
For them to succeed and that to reflect well on the people who bought them.
Mm.
And they are not the reasons that Arsenal was bought. But, so I'd say that if you're thinking about it from a purely sporting perspective, you probably do want to be bought by someone like Abu Dhabi or Roman Abramovich. But my instincts tell me that Arsenal fans wouldn't be comfortable with that. A lot of Arsenal fans. Maybe that's changing though. Maybe increasingly they would. Maybe bizarrely the kind of sports washing thing ends up being a more kind of purer sporting pursuit because it's about the growth of the reputation of that club. Do you know what I mean? It's really tricky.
It is. It is. And it just makes you realise there's no good way out, probably.
No, I mean, that is sort of probably the, you know, unless you get the kind of lightning bolt from above magically creates the kind of 50+1 model, then I don't know what your best bet is. I think the short answer is like, what does the ideal billionaire look like? Probably it's not one. Probably it's some sort of consortium, right? Probably it's faceless money with smart people at the front of it. You know, but...
And smart people aren't that easy to find either, so...
No, well, that's we've discovered.
Right, well, look, on that upbeat note, I think we'll leave it there because we've been recording for the best part of 2 hours now, so we really need to knock this one on the head, get it out, and get a good night's sleep and everything else. We do have a massive game on Thursday, of course, in Spain over at Villarreal. We will preview that during the week for Patreon members, patreon.com/arseblog. As ever, thank you very much indeed for being here. Really appreciate it, as always. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we will catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.